Golf Today.
Hello, it's Golf Today on a Tuesday. Damon Hack alongside Eamon Lynch, Golf Week Magazine. Missed yesterday, big guy. How was your Monday? Mine was pretty good.
Well, I actually worked. I'm guessing you were missing fairways when you were despoiling yet another major championship venue.
Fair enough to say I was at the first tee New York event, Metropolitan NY at Wingfoot West, raising money for a good cause. And, yeah, I took some mighty divots out of that sod. On occasion, hit a couple stripes, beautiful irons as well. You can't play Wingfoot West or East. I played East on Friday, by the way. You can't play from the rough at one of the greatest golf courses, championship venues in creation.
This doesn't happen on this show very often, but I can already say he's turned the audience in my favor within the first minute of being on the air, and I'm so happy for that. But let's actually talk about somebody who can handle major championship venues. A big story in this game, at least for another day or two. Scottie Scheffler, Sunday at Quail Hollow, he won the PGA Championship, answering the most obtuse question in golf. And Scheffler and his caddy, Ted Scott, win a major outside of Augusta National. He's now a three-time major champion and a 15-time winner on the PGA Tour, and that puts him in some pretty elite company. Only two other guys have managed that at this young an age, Jack Nicklaus and Tiger Woods. So, Damon, what did you make of it? Because what struck me about Scottie Scheffler was how unruffled he was by everything. Even when he wobbled, it was just simply a matter of alignment. Even the fix was simple, I guess. Mm. This is a guy who keeps his entire life, his career, very simple, very uncluttered. And when he misses a few drives left, his caddy says, aim a little bit farther right. It's too simple to be believable, but that is how Scottie Scheffler hit a very impressive reset button in the middle of what looked like he was suddenly going to make an interesting tournament out of it.
A handful of guys who can kind of diagnose their swing in the middle of a round and actually make that change in real time. Tiger Woods was famous at it. Scottie Scheffler seems to be an heir to that skill set. We call Scottie relentless. I think he's ruthless. I draw a direct line from Quail Hollow all the way back to Valhalla. I think that's why we saw a little bit of the fist pumps and almost a little bit of anger and take that in how he was behaving down the stretch as he pulled away from Jon Rahm after they were tied. You could see him grit his teeth. You could see him say, this is mine. When you think about 2024, he'd won four times before Valhalla. He'd won API and Players back to back. He'd won the Masters and the RBC Heritage back to back. We're talking about two of the five biggest tournaments in the world and two signature events. Dusting the field, that opportunity to win the PGA last year was taken from him on Friday morning.
You still think that was?
I do. I think he feels like his normal routine, and I know he shot that kind of out of body experience 66 on Friday.
I'd go to jail to shoot 66.
I would too. And then he had that 73 kind of fall back to earth on Saturday. But I do think there was a sense of that he was wronged last year, and he was going to make things right last week at Quail Hollow, and that's exactly what he did. Scottie Scheffler got even last week.
Do you think there's an inevitability about him as the way there was about Tiger back in the day where the other players realized this is a guy who is not going to go anywhere? Because he talked about how he didn't have his best stuff on Thursday, didn't have his best stuff on Friday. In fact, probably didn't find his best stuff until the last five holes on Saturday. But yet, that's where he was distancing himself because he'd kept himself in the mix all the way up to that point. There just does seem to be an inevitability about this guy. When he puts himself close to the leaderboard, he doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
He doesn't wobble at all.
Yeah, there's a beautiful inevitability, but also a simplicity to his team, to his process. We see Scottie, and there's Meredith, and now baby Bennett, and there's Randy Smith, and there are the parents, Scott and Diane. I mean, it's like, here we go. It's like, we're seeing this crew every week, and it's the same faces, same coach he's had since the age of seven, and he is just not worried about the zeros on the check.
But
he wants to win.
What's not there. It's very important what is there, but to me, it's almost important what's not there. He's not doing the social media routine.
Yeah.
He's not hawking any product on a given week. He's not doing TGL. He's not doing tour politics in any respect. He's not out there cluttering his life with anything other than the family at home and the job inside the ropes. And I think these days that makes it an awful lot more simple, because you make an argument. Obviously, Rory McIlroy seemed to play better when he was on the board for a time as well. But you could make an argument that the more involved Patrick Cantlay has become on the board and those responsibilities, that his game has suffered for that over
Speaking
the last couple of years.
Of Rory McIlroy, we go from this joyful story in April to what happened last week. I just was surprised to read and hear that he was walking past reporters and didn't want to talk after any of the four rounds at Quail Hollow. I don't know what was going on with Rory. I love interviewing him. I find him incredibly thoughtful and open. And coming off of completing the career Grand Slam and thinking of the word that he was being used to describe him, unburdened by that, and how the thought was at Quail Hollow, where he'd won four times previously, that he would play unburdened golf. I just wonder what happened last week that he was so off of his game, whether it was inside the ropes or outside the ropes, that he wouldn't speak to the media for four straight days?
Yeah, I thought that was not a good look, and certainly not a good look for someone who's been an advocate of the need for tour players to sell their own product
right
out there. And yes, he did a pre-tournament interview, which he always does every week. He's on that list. He also did a walk and talk on our air on Wednesday with Johnson Wagner as well. So it's not as though he was completely absent. It was the post-round interviews. Now, you can make an argument, okay, he wasn't a factor after any round in the tournament, but he is the reigning Masters champion. He's someone who sought out. And Rory did make the point at the Masters, whenever we were having this debate that Colin Morikawa started, over whether or not the players do owe some kind of media obligations. And I've always argued it's not that they owe the media anything. They owe the consumers of their product something. And the way in which the consumers of their product follow up on those storylines that they've invested their day on is via the media. So it's irrelevant whether or not he talks to us. It's the consumer of the end product is ultimately who's been underserved here. And Rory made the point of the Masters that that isn't mandatory.
Right.
And he raised the question, should it be mandatory? And, you know, that's a question at some point I think the tour is going to have to face, because at a certain stage we have to get somewhere where something in this game is not organised purely based on the convenience to the players, because that's all that seems to matter in this game anymore, is that let's not inconvenience a player. And this isn't a Rory McIlroy thing. He doesn't blow off the media that often, although he started to do it a little more recently. He shouldn't have done it after Pinehurst last year either. But it's the idea that the entire game and the entire PGA Tour, and particularly the PGA of America's championship every year, everything is organized. Let's not inconvenience the players. It's getting boring.
And the players are making it inconvenient for themselves. I've befuddled why Rory McIlroy would now allow this story to kind of go into the next week or the week after, where we see him probably at Memorial, and why Colin Morikawa would allow his disappointment at Bay Hill, and then would double down on that at the players instead of just say, hey, you know what? Maybe I put it in artfully. I just to kind of let that story continue instead of just saying, you know what? I made a mistake. I was hot under the collar. You know, I'm good with you guys. I'm good with the media for the most part. I think there is a bit of bubble wrap around players from time to time when I'd like to see a bit more of a stronger chin.
Yeah, and I think no one's really all that surprised or that bothered if somebody blows off media once in a while. You know, they're angry after a lousy finish to a round.
Yeah.
It's so unusual, and we've never seen it from Rory McIlroy before, to blow it off 4 days in a row. Maybe he was irked by the coverage of the driver failing testing, because there was a lot of bad faith actors, frankly, out there on social media who aren't members of golf media, but perpetuating this kind of nonsense around the driver being somewhat suspicious. But he also blew off Thursday night, and that was before the driver story became public on Friday. He had a lousy finish to the round on Thursday as well. It's unusual. At a certain point, the tour needs to figure out what the obligation or responsibility is. And in some cases, in tournaments, should it be a condition of entry that if you are requested by media after a round, that you at least show up, even if you're going to be surly and short answers or whatever else? But is it an obligation or a responsibility of some kind?
Something we'll continue to talk about, no doubt, as the weeks go on. Meanwhile, the PGA Tour in Fort Worth, Texas this week at Colonial for the Charles Schwab Challenge. Reminder, you can catch live first round coverage this Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern time right here on Golf Channel. Strong field in Fort Worth. Scotty back to work this week. He has yet to win at Colonial, but has a couple of runner-up finishes there to Davis Riley last year, Sam Burns 3 years ago. Strong mix of major champs, PGA Tour winners, DP World Tour winners posting up this week in Fort Worth, Texas. With more on the world number one, let's welcome in Rex Hogg, who's on site for us all week. Rex, great to see you. What's the latest with Scotty? How's he going to handle his schedule this week? He's got to be tired.
He's tired and he's going to take it easy. I talked to his swing coach today. He wasn't out here, and I asked Randy Smith exactly what he was doing. He said, not much of anything. Clearly, last week took a lot out of him, both physically and mentally. And Randy's line to me, Scotty's plan today was to, quote, put a dent in his couch. So you get an idea of how he was going to spend his Tuesday. Now, he will be on property on Wednesday. You look at the Pro-Am is going to tee off around noon. He's scheduled to talk with the media afterwards. And that is just a nine-hole Pro-Am. So it's a really abbreviated warm-up for a tournament. But if anyone can get away with it, it's probably Scotty. This is going to be his sixth start in this event, and you just mentioned it. Look at his last three starts here. He finished second, third, second. So I don't think Scotty's worrying about being rusty coming in here.
Rex, over the last few weeks, the PGA Tour has allowed distance measuring devices, rangefinders, to be used out there on tour as part of a study to gather data about speed of play issues. That period is wrapping up now. Are the players giving you any kind of insight about what impact, if any, the use of these devices has actually had?
Yeah, it was interesting. And this was part of a broader initiative, as you mentioned, that was introduced at the Players' Championship back in March by PGA Tour Commissioner Jay Monahan. The idea that it's going to be a multifaceted approach. And this was going to be the first, introducing distance measuring devices on the PGA Tour. And clearly, it's still a little bit too early. The tour hasn't really crunched the numbers, doesn't have any conclusions as of yet. But the players we talked to today at Colonial, they all felt like it was a step in the right direction.
I don't know. I haven't seen the data and the numbers. Personally, I don't like it. I like pacing my yardages, and I like it just kind of a little more old school. But I understand why we're trying to do it. We're trying to shave some time off of the rounds of golf that are taking a little bit long. But at the same time, if we shave 2-3 minutes of 18 holes, did we really accomplish our goal? I don't know. I like to get back, look at the numbers, see the data, analyze, and see what happened.
Yeah, we used it on pretty much every shot, really. I think I liked it. I mean, it's kind of more normal, I guess. Like, you know, if you're playing just casually, I'm always going to use a rangefinder, and then we have pin sheets, so zap the pin, still calculating the front of the green, the back of the green. So, yeah, I thought it was good. Yeah, it doesn't make any difference how you're going to execute a golf shot. I think it was good. I'd be very interested to see sort of how the experiment went and if it did make a difference.
Honestly, not really. In certain situations, maybe if you're a little, you know, offline or something like that, it makes it a little easier than having to walk over, get a rough idea of what you're, you know, parallel to and get your yardage that way. So in very, you know, certain circumstances, it definitely helps speed up, you know, that shot. But you know, for the most part, the last few weeks, I stepped off our number. Rick would shoot it, you know, they're always within, you know, 1-2 yards, as we would expect, if not right on. So as far as our process went, it didn't change that. But I'm also a pretty quick player, so could be different for some other guys.
Now, technically, the PGA Championship was not part of this five-week experiment the PGA Tour introduced. The PGA of America actually introduced the use of distance measuring devices in their championships way back in 2019. And last week, I had a chance to ask Chief Championships Officer Kerry Haig if there has been any impact. And he said it's kind of assessed exactly what it has done. They play their championships on different golf courses each year. But in his mind, he said there is no doubt it has made a difference. Guys?
Rex Hogg reporting on what looks to be a beautiful day in Fort Worth, Texas. Thank you, Rex. Much more with you in just a little bit.
Well, most U.S. Open final qualifying takes place in a couple of weeks. That's on golf's longest day. But yesterday was a qualifier in Dallas, Texas. Some big names, including this former Masters champion, were trying to play their way to Oakmont. We'll tell you whether Sergio Garcia made it next.
More on what transpired yesterday out at Bent Tree. We welcome back Rex Hoggard. Rex?
Damon, you've covered enough of those U.S. Open qualifiers, and as is the norm, there was a ton of drama yesterday at Bentry Country Club, and you mentioned that 7-for-1 playoff was probably the highlight. It ended up going four holes, Johnny Kiefer birdieing the last. They would not have been able to play anymore. There was darkness. They probably would have had to come back Tuesday morning, but he birdied the last, earned his first trip, and you touched on it. It is interesting. There was kind of a good news, bad news situation for some LIV golfers. The good news was Carlos Ortiz. He had rounds of 68, 66. It earned his first trip back since 2023. And then Sergio is interesting. He was inside the cut line for really the vast majority of the day until he bogeyed that last hole to fall one shot out of the playoff. It would have been a bit of a seminal moment for Sergio going back to Oakmont. Back in 2016, he finished tied for fifth there. So it probably would have been a good fit for him, but it didn't work out.
Back on Golf Today, First Tee began in 1997 as a partnership among the LPGA, the Masters Tournament, the PGA of America, the PGA Tour, and the USGA to make golf affordable and accessible for all kids. For more than two decades now, First Tee has been committed to helping kids build character, strength, and important life skills through the game. Lots going on with First Tee this week in particular, celebrating coaches and participants, some important fundraising happening as well for programs where young people learn about the nine core values, including integrity and sportsmanship. And yesterday, Eamon and Matt Adams spent some time with a special guest.
And Greg McLaughlin is the CEO and president of the First Tee, and Greg joins us now. Greg, this is the first First Tee week. Tell us exactly what it is you're trying to accomplish.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you for having me. As we approach our 30th year of the First Tee, our goal was to try and highlight and recognize the great work that our chapters are doing around the country and internationally as well. And we're recognizing our coaches, and the inspiration for this kickoff that's happening this week is called Dear Coach. We have 5,000 trained background check coaches that are acting as mentors, delivering the programs to our young people, again, domestically and around the world. So for us, it's a way to highlight and recognizing the great work that they're doing.
Greg, you just mentioned 30 years. It is mind-blowing to think that you guys have reached that milestone, and where this week we are recognizing these coaches. Could you take us through the bridge from concept to where we stand today, and how many lives have been impacted by what you guys are doing?
Yeah, I mean, we have to credit, you know, former Commissioner Tim Fincham, really, for having the vision and partnering with Augusta National Golf Club, PGA of America, USGA have all remained, you know, partners and supporters, as well as the PGA Tour, in launching the First Tee again nearly 30 years ago. And we created an alumni program last year where we've started to reach out to these 15 to 20 million young people that have gone through the program. Again, many of them around the world today. So for us, it's trying to reconnect with them, understand the impact that First Tee's had on their lives. And, you know, for us, it's a great way to really celebrate. And again, this week, First Tee Week, is a way to really to bring attention to the work that we're doing, and we're coming into our golf season right now in many of the cold weather climates, so it's a great way to reconnect as well.
Greg, the First Tee commissioned some research on the impact that coaches actually have on the kids in your program. What did you learn from that research?
You know, the Harris poll, it's the third year that we've had Harris do an independent study where they polled some 2,000 parents asking them about the impact that coaches have had in their children's lives. And the numbers are extraordinary, and they continue to grow, and they highlight the specifics of the impact that coaches have positively in young people's development, not only in athletics, but also in academics. And they talk about today that coaches, all type of coaches, really act as mentors for young people. And that's what our coaches do, is they're mentors, helping them through life, teaching them the game of golf for the First Tee, but then also developing character and all the inherent values that come through the game of golf. So we're pleased with the results in the Harris poll, and we feel like our more than 5,000 coaches are reaching young people in a very meaningful way.
Greg, how important is it to have opportunities like this when you can speak to the merits of what the first tee is doing, be it in the field of mentorship through your coaches or these life lessons that kids are learning, that this isn't just about putting a golf club in their hand and learning the merits of a love for the lifetime before them of this game of golf. It is so, so much more.
Yeah, I mean, our outreach, we have approximately 150 chapters, mostly domestic, 6 international. Our program's taught in 12,000 schools. Of those, more than 50% are Title I schools. And then there's another 2,000 youth-serving organizations, Boys and Girls Clubs, YMCAs, and outlying areas in the Wyomings, Montanas, North Dakotas. And currently, our chapters are reaching 39% of our participants are females, 50% are individuals from underrepresented communities. So for us, you know, it's continuing to promote the game of golf, the game that we think teach young people so many values in life that help them. What someone once said was that, you know, in school they get a lot of the basic academics, but through the First Tee program, it's all the soft skills, the things that, you know, potentially you don't need or you don't know, I guess, as you're going through life. And, you know, character development is a big part of it. You're not really taught character. It's something that you develop. And we're really proud of the work that our chapters are doing domestically and, again, around the world.
It's a great opportunity then that we have to celebrate what the First Tee has accomplished through those three decades past. But I got to ask you the question. Tim Finchem is one that was always looking forward, always about what's around the corner and getting better for the next day. What is it for the First Tee now? What do you want to accomplish next?
And well said about Tim and Tim's vision some 30 years ago for having it along with President Bush 41 and great leaders that were helping him as part of it. I mean, our priorities are very simple. You know, we want to continue to grow the program. I mentioned the outreach that we have through the chapter level. Youth safety is critical to what we're doing to continue to make sure our young people are safe and they have a safe place to go, really, as part of that. We've made a big investment in technology to try and reach more kids through our technology and our outreach. And then, as I mentioned earlier, you know, the alumni. One of the great things that Arthur Blank, who's, you know, been a longtime supporter of First Tee, said young people only represent 1/3 of the population, but they're 100% of our future. And I think that's pretty well said when you really think about it. And that's our focus. And that's what we continue to do every day.
Greg, it's always good to catch up with you. And it's nice to see the coaches actually getting their due, since we do tend to talk about the kids so much. Appreciate the time.
Thank you guys very much. We appreciate it.